John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, January 3rd, 2012. While Palestinians and Israelis meet in Jordan in bid to revive peace talks, Israel is planning to expand its settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas warned against the failure of the recent attempts to renew peace talks. He said the success of the new talks depends on Israel's acceptance of the Palestinian terms to freeze all settlement activities and to recognize the two-state solution. If Israel fails to accommodate such terms by January 26, the Palestinian Authority will have to take some hard measures. By January 26, the 3 months set by the International Quartet Committee to revive peace talks will end. Abbas refrained from mentioning what the measures could be. However, he said the PA is not ready for that yet. The Palestinian president's statements came after the meeting that joined senior Palestinian and Israeli officials in the Jordanian capital, Amman, on Tuesday. On their part, a number of Palestinian political factions slammed the meeting, saying it will weaken the position of the Palestinian Authority and will serve Israel's policies. The Palestinian Authority has said repeatedly it will not hold meetings with Israeli officials until clear standards and goals are set for these meetings or talks. Meanwhile, Chief Palestinian Negotiator Dr. Sabi Arikat stated that the meeting does not mean resuming peace talks with Tel Aviv. Arikat added the Palestinian stance is clear regarding refusing to resume peace talks with Israel until it halts its violations and settlement activities. He also stated that the PA accepted an invitation from Jordan's King Abdullah II to meet with Israeli delegates and with representatives of the Quartet Committee. In other news, Israeli troops kidnapped a Palestinian young woman near Qalqilya Tuesday morning. Palestinian media sources said Maha Barham, 19, from the village of Kfar Kaddoum, east of Qalqilya, was detained and kidnapped at the northern entrance of Qalqilya. Eyewitnesses said the woman was seen handcuffed and put in an army vehicle and was taken to unknown destination. The sources said Barham was detained on her way back from Israeli jail where she was visiting her sister. Her family demanded the Palestinian Ministry of Prisoners Affairs and human rights organizations to intervene to know their daughter's whereabouts and to push for her immediate release. The Civic Coalition for Defending Palestinians' Rights in Jerusalem revealed Tuesday information from Israeli newspapers about Israeli plans to expand settlements in East Jerusalem. The coalition said in a statement published Tuesday that Israel is planning to build 117 settlement units in Har Homa settlement, illegally built on Abu Ghneim Hill, south of Jerusalem. In addition, Israeli authorities are planning to expand Har Adar settlement, built on lands that belong to villagers from Katanna and Biddo, northwest of Jerusalem, and 213 settlement units in five locations in the Efrat settlement south of Bethlehem, in addition to a number of settlement units in Givat Hazait in the center of Jerusalem. That sums up our news for today. Thank you for joining us from occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and George Ishmael.
From a small office on a busy street in Tel Aviv, Israel, a trio of women produced the influential website Who Profits? It's a project of the Women's Coalition for Peace that investigates companies that profit from the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, part of the Palestinian occupied territories. They research global companies involved in construction, communication, and in some cases, exploitation of Palestinian resources for export. Rona Moran, one of the Israeli women researchers, explains that the project was born out of a heated debate about whether the Women's Coalition should support the call by many Palestinian civil society groups for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, known as BDS. Researching the companies that profit was a compromised position, a way of collecting more information, but it has also become an invaluable tool for solidarity activists all over the world. In exposing companies and corporations involved in the occupation, the group hopes to promote a change in public opinion and corporate policies, leading to an end to the occupation. The fact that one of the researchers is a Palestinian-Israeli citizen means she can visit parts of the West Bank for her research that the other two women are barred from. On a recent visit to Israel on the West Bank, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Rona Moran, who talks about the effectiveness of their project in exposing companies that profit from the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land.
What we are doing, we are an information center and for calls and for questions from all over the world of activists that are asking, what is the situation? Is this company involved in activity in the West Bank? And we can say, this is the situation right now. They withdrew from, they closed their factory, they invested in this company. And the fact that we are able to read in Hebrew and to check and monitor the activities of these companies allow us to spread this information for a very vast community of activists all over the world. Our function in this system is to provide the most accurate and updated information that we can find.
Can you tell me about any particular information that you found through your research that turned out to be really useful for folks who are interested in this issue?
For example, last week we had some French activists over here and they asked about French companies, and then I told them about the involvement of Veolia in the occupied territories. It's a huge French company that is involved in infrastructure projects, usually working on the transportation, water, garbage disposal, things like that. And they are heavily involved in the building and operating of the light rail train in Jerusalem, which is a massive project that was built in order to connect the settlement in the east side of Jerusalem into the west side of the city. So they practically built it, and there was a very intense international campaign against it. But during the research, at the beginning, we only knew about the light rail, but as we checked all the subsidiaries of the company, we discovered that they have a landfill in the Jordan Valley. and that they transfer and they waste from inside Israel into the occupied territories to that landfill. And we discovered that they operate through their transportation unit and a subsidiary called Connex, a few bus lines that go on apartheid roads from Modi'in Ilit to Jerusalem and Bet Horon area, and Palestinians are not allowed to use this road. So the deeper you go, the more things come up. For example, the information about the landfill was received from a request for information that we filed for the civil administrations and Ministry of Security. And so we received the information, and 2 days later it was, you know, spread to... So it's important to us that we will be able to provide information, you know, on real time sometimes. Usually we work with the information that companies publish themselves on their websites, on marketing materials, in reports that they file for the state or for financial issues. Their annual reports is one of the best information sources there are. Sometimes you get all the information and you get it fast. Sometimes security issues do come up, and then we have to apply to the Supreme Court in several occasions.
We just spoke to someone who works, you know, on the BDS campaign, and he says it's been very successful. You know, in the 6 years since it started, it's really kind of taken off, and there is some awareness around the world about it. How do you view it? Do you think that it is a successful campaign, and if so, how do you judge that?
I can say it only as a fellow activist and not as a part of the project. I think that the economic pressure is heavily felt by Israeli companies and by the Israeli government, who fear this campaign greatly. And you can see it in hysterical reactions of diplomatic Israeli representatives all over the world when they have to address the issue of the boycott. I think we are only getting started. This is only the beginning. The more information that we'll have on this issue and the more successful campaigns that we will have, I believe that international companies will find it a lot more complicated to be involved in this kind of activity. I think that the most important thing that we can say about the project is that it reveals something that people usually don't understand. When you speak about economic activity in the occupied territories, people think about settlement products. Settlement products are almost insignificant. They are such a small portion of the economic activity that is going on in the West Bank that dealing with it is like, it's like peanuts. The involvement of Israeli companies in the Israeli economic system in the West Bank is massive. It's undeniable, and it involves banks and construction companies and law firms, and every part of the Israeli market is there. The fact that Israeli companies use the Palestinian market as a captive market, it's such an enormous advantage for them. So in many ways, we want to show the wider picture. And to show that the involvement doesn't stop at the green line. You don't have to have a factory in a settlement in order to be involved over there. So this is the main thing.
That was Rona Moran of the research project Who Profits. To find a link to the group's website and additional information, visit our website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan. Yesterday, NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Bagram Air Base, Afghanistan, New Year's Eve. The Taliban hammered the largest U.S. base in Afghanistan with 9 long-range missiles. Taliban spokesman Zabulya Mojahid claimed the attack killed soldiers in the base. This claim was disputed by the Afghan government. No reports of casualties resulting from the attack have emerged since. It has long been known that U.S. bases in nations with active insurgencies that use indirect fire weapons always have hardened shelters against rockets and mortar rounds. Makuba, Iraq, New Year's Eve. 6 Sawa, or Awakening fighters, were killed in an attack on a checkpoint near the city. The Awakening fighters are former insurgents who changed sides to support the U.S. in 2007 and have been regarded by the rest of the nation's various insurgent groups as traitors ever since. New York City, yesterday, an unknown terrorist threw a Molotov cocktail at a mosque. The NYFD got the fire outside Imam Al-Khoi Foundation building in Queens under control soon after receiving the call. Another fire was reported at a Hindu site. Had the attacker been a Muslim and the target anything else, the mainstream press would be screaming about terrorism, but when American Muslims face arson attacks, there is little mention and no use of the word terrorism. Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The notorious Gitmo U.S. prison is still open 3 years after Obama took office, promising to shut it down. Now Mr. Obama has signed the NDAA bill that requires Guantanamo-style detention for anyone arrested for terrorism. But surely this will not apply to domestic terrorists who firebomb mosques, abortion clinics, or gay bars. On January 11th, protesters, including Occupy DC protesters, will take to the streets demanding that Guantanamo Bay be closed forever. 5 years ago, I said that when you arrive at Guantanamo Bay, you know that there is a hell. You know that there is a devil. And his name was George W. Bush. Will people arrested under the NDAA and sent into the hell of indefinite military detention say the same about Barack Obama? Mr. Barack Obama, it's time to deliver on your promises. Remove that oversized U.S. embassy with all those mercenaries from Iraq. Bring the troops home from Afghanistan and close the hellhole at Guantanamo Bay forever.
After 18 months in custody, Army Private First Class Bradley Manning made his first public appearance just before Christmas at what's known as an Article 32 pretrial hearing at Fort Meade, Maryland. The hearing is the required next step in the military's legal process before the expected court-martial of the 24-year-old Manning that will likely begin in 6 to 9 months. Private Manning stands accused by the U.S. government of being the source of 260,000 diplomatic government cables and more than 90,000 intelligence reports later distributed to the press by WikiLeaks. Manning, who has been held in solitary confinement under conditions that his attorney and supporters characterize as cruel and degrading, faces 22 charges, including aiding the enemy, which carry a possible 30 years in jail. Manning's lawyer, David Coombs, has based his defense strategy on two main points. One, the leaks did little real damage to U.S. national security. And two, the military's lax security in running Manning's intelligence unit and their failure to notice and take action to address behavior indicating Private Manning was suffering from psychological distress. Your reporter spoke with Rainey Reitman, a steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. She summarizes what took place at Manning's pretrial hearing and concerns about how the hearing was conducted and the direction of the prosecution's case.
The way the hearing sort of unfolded, the government, the prosecution, was basing its argument line basically around forensic analysis. They collected all these different computers that Bradley Manning had used at different times and then did forensic analysis on them to try and pinpoint data that indicated Manning had accessed documents that later came up on the WikiLeaks website. And the defense took a different tactic. The defense said, we are here not just to discuss what happened or how it happened, but to discuss why it happened and to talk about this larger issue of government transparency. One of the major focal points of the defense's argument is that there have been no negative repercussions to this information being published, and that what is being charged against Bradley Manning is an enormous overreaction, that he should not be facing 150 years in prison, 24-year-old guy, just trying to make this country a better place, for something that, in effect, did not have any negative impact on our soldiers overseas or on our negotiations in world spheres. So that was one of their core arguments. I believe many of the witnesses that were denied were going to speak to that particular issue.
What kind of penalty do the charges that Bradley Manning faces, what is his possible jail sentence if he is convicted for these crimes? And I know the defense is concerned that the harshness of the sentence that he may be liable to get is in part a way to pressure him to cooperate with the prosecution to pursue a prosecution against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. You want to speak to that, please?
Yes, the I think you nailed it on the head. The defense and many of the analysts who've been watching this case believe that the government is pursuing Bradley Manning in this particularly harsh manner because they are hoping to get him to testify against WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and also to make an example of him. The charges altogether, if Manning were to be convicted of all of them and get the highest sentence, would be some 150 years in prison. The death penalty is actually still on the table. The prosecution has stated that they aren't, at this point anyway, going to pursue the death penalty, though it's certainly possible that that's something that could be faced. The defense has asked that most of these charges be dropped, especially egregious ones like aiding the enemy, and that instead they face simple overstepping classification boundaries and something more to the tune of, maximum charge, 30 years. And so what we're waiting for now is for the investigating officer to review the information that was reported to him and decide if he's going to recommend that all of those charges go to a court-martial or whether they should be reduced before the court-martial.
Rainey, I wanted to discuss with you the allegation by the defense that there is an epidemic of overclassified U.S. government documents that in some way led somebody like Bradley Manning to release them, thinking that the public has a right to know many of the things that were divulged in the documents that WikiLeaks eventually did release to the public and the press. Tell us a bit about overclassification as an issue here.
Well, this has actually become a huge issue of public controversy. As you probably know, in 2010 alone, there were 77 million documents classified by our government. That's a 40% jump over the prior year. And the number of people with security clearances is around 4.2 million. That's more people than there are in the city of Los Angeles. The classification of documents has become the default in our military culture. There's this idea to constantly hide things away, but many of the things that are being so carefully classified are not only things that won't hurt or endanger our military work overseas, they also are attempts to cover up some very concerning situations that happen. So, for example, one of the leaks that has not come out yet, has yet to be published, but is attributed to Bradley Manning, is the Guarani airstrike, also known as the Granai massacre, in which there's an airstrike by U.S. military forces that killed, I think it was a total of about 120 people. I'm not sure on the total, but it was 90 school children. And this is along with the video collateral murder, which shows two Reuters journalists getting gunned down by Americans. Some of the things that Manning saw that led him to speak out and to leak documents. So there's this idea that there was no method, no mechanism in place whatsoever that someone like Bradley Manning would have had a way to get that information out other than leaking it, because there's no way to really unclassify documents for somebody like Bradley Manning, who saw something that disturbed his conscience.
That was Rainey Reitman, a steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. Learn more about the issues in the Bradley Manning case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. New Year's Eve. Occupy Wall Street, reoccupy Zuccotti Square, and march through the streets of Lower Manhattan. At midnight, it was reported that Occupy Wall Street had torn down the fences erected after they were evicted and arrested seven tenants in their place. In response, they were met with a sickening chorus of police brutality, both in the park and on the street. At least 68 people were arrested, some with brutal force.
I can't breathe!
What? Back up!
Occupy Wall Street's live stream video observers were physically thrown out of areas under attack instead of arrested in a futile attempt by the New York police to conceal their crimes. At one point, the pigs blockaded the sidewalk, pushed a street march into the blockade, then threatened to arrest everyone inside for blockading the sidewalk in a repeat of their unlawful trap and detain strategy that resulted in a class action lawsuit after 700 people were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. One protester was charged with a felony for allegedly trying to defend himself from the mindless police brutality with a pair of scissors. His lawyer says the police claim of being slashed with the scissors is bullshit, and given the history of lies from the New York cops about Occupy Wall Street, I'm inclined to believe him. No matter how satisfying it would be if people really did start to resist police brutality with armed force. At least the judge denied the NYPD's request for $12,000 bail, and he was released on a $500 bail instead. Here's what the police attack on Occupy Wall Street sounded like. Was from an incident where Occupy Wall Street did in fact manage to force the police to retreat from an attempt to arrest someone, though no weapons were used. Instead, everyone grabbed onto the young man the police were trying to brutalize and drag him to safety while swarming protesters held the pigs at bay. No scissors were used, and unfortunately no cop got his grabbing, choking hand slashed off of someone's neck. Cops lie, video tells the truth. Meanwhile, here in D.C., park police tried to search tents that occupy D.C. over New Year's Eve, only to scatter like cockroaches when the light comes on when the livestream videographer was summoned to record their misconduct. A guerrilla artwork was installed at Occupy D.C. December 30th, ripped down by the park police on December 31st, and reinstalled on January 2nd. On January 3rd, the park police again tried to remove it, only to give up after protesters picked it up as a unit and demonstrated that it is portable. Meanwhile, Occupy DC was threatened with eviction on the 2nd of January unless her kitchen was brought up to the codes affecting commercial restaurants. In 3 months, nobody has gotten sick eating at Occupy DC, yet on the coldest day of the year, the kitchen tent is closed because of this order. The kitchen crew is attempting to comply with these commercial codes and promises to reopen within 2 days. Congress cowers in fear of Occupy DC. That's the reason the reflecting pool area between 1st and 3rd Streets is being transferred to Capitol Police jurisdiction. You know what's coming on the 17th of January. Ha! Twitter has just gotten caught suspending or deleting accounts of users who talk too much about Occupy Wall Street. One user, David Seaman at the Business Insider, reported that his account was suspended for annoying our users after just 2 tweets about Occupy Wall Street that must have been followed by the wrong people. This is in spite of the fact that those who do not like Occupy Wall Street could have simply unfollowed him. Doing a little digging, he found 3 more users who had been removed from Twitter for the same so-called offense. Hey Twitter, this is some change from standing down a service upgrade that would have disrupted service during the revolt in Iran. What does Occupy Wall Street need to do to avoid random account suspensions? Move to Iran? Seriously, folks, this is why I've been telling you for years to never trust corporate social media like Facebook and obviously Twitter as well. Any cloud service owned by a corporation and supporting itself by advertisements has a vested interest in censoring and snitching on any kind of activism that threatens corporate profits. Still wonder why we need things like pirate radio and independent media centers that don't support themselves by advertising?
My name is Eric Sheptock. I am known as the homeless advocate. And today, I am doing my first state of homelessness address. And I should begin by saying that I've been advocating for Washington, D.C.'s homeless community for about 5.5 years now. I began advocating in June of 2006. And before I talk about the events of the past year, let me give you a very quick update on how things have gone ever since I began advocating for the homeless. We started with Franklin School Shelter when Anthony Williams, the former mayor of Washington, D.C., threatened to close the shelter, and we actually won against him and stopped the closure, and then a man named Adrian Venter became mayor in January 2007, and even though he had promised during his campaign to keep Franklin School open as a shelter, he ended up closing it in September of 2008. Well, as it turns out, Washington, D.C. counts its homeless people every January, and in January of 2008, we counted 6,044 homeless people. 8 months later, when Franklin School Shelter was closed, Mayor Fenty actually began the Permanent Supportive Housing Program. That program has now housed approximately 1,500 homeless people. But in spite of that, in 2011, in January, we counted 6,546 homeless people. So, even though the homeless are being housed, we still have more than 500 additional homeless people. And what that brings to mind is the fact that we're always behind the ball. You know, in spite of the programs that are being created, we can't seem to house people more quickly than they become homeless. And that is a lingering problem in terms of ending homelessness on the local level as well as on the federal level. And I've been telling many people about this issue and really admonishing them to figure out a new way of trying to end homelessness. How can we get in front of the ball? And the simple answer would be that we need to figure out how people are becoming homeless, and we need to capture them before they enter shelter. There's a certain analogy that I give people where I say, if your water supply line is leaking in your house, you don't mop the floor first, you stop the leak. You go turn off the water. If the water is still running and it's still flowing all over the floor, there's no point in mopping, right? And so you stop the flow into homelessness, and then you clean up what you already have. Now, many folk have made the point to me, and I agree, that it's not either or, it's both and. But as it turns out, on both the federal level and the local level here in Washington, D.C., we have people who are trying to get those who are homeless out of homelessness, but they're not stopping folk from flowing in. And so we have to do both. So now we have Vincent Gray as mayor. Now Vincent Gray actually has a history of working in human services. In the 90s, he was the director of DC government's Department of Human Services. And we thought that his history working in human services would factor into what he did for the homeless while mayor. But unfortunately, it hasn't. And so, according to D.C. law, on April 1st, 2011, Vincent Gray issued his budget proposal. And in that budget proposal, it said that there was a $20.5 million budget shortfall for homeless services. Now, that doesn't mean money was taken out. What that means is that in this year, it would cost more to do the same things that we did last year, and it also means that some federal money was taken away, and so that ended up with us having a $20.5 million budget shortfall as DC government had to fill the gap for what federal monies were no longer receiving. And so the government threatened to close all DC city-run shelters on April 1st of 2012. The advocates came out in force. There was a day that we had about 250 advocates in City Hall, in the John A. Wilson building, pressuring the council to find money to fill the gap for homeless services and to keep the shelters open beyond April 1st of 2012. And they found $17 million. They took it from the Housing Production Trust Fund and they put it into homeless services. Well, as it turns out, I was at a COHO meeting on April 14th before the money was found. And COHO stands for Coalition of Housing and Homeless Organizations. They meet on the second Thursday of every month. And while there, we were talking about the impending crisis and how that the shelters were threatened to be shut down on April 1st of 2012. And a man named John said, "Who's going to tell the poor and the homeless about these cuts that are going to directly affect them?" And John, myself, and several other people met after that meeting, and we made arrangements to meet in the basement of the CCNV homeless shelter, that is the Community for Creative Nonviolence, where I presently reside. And the director, Rico Harris, was very gracious and offered us that space, and we began to meet every Monday from 1 to 3 in the drop-in. And we've been meeting now for about 8 months. But nonetheless, going back to the budget fight, the city did find $17 million, and the shelters are going to be saved and kept open year-round, because the way DC law reads, they only have to shelter the homeless for the 5 coldest months of the year, from November 1st, or the first freezing night, if it comes before November 1st, until April, or until March 31st, or the last freezing night. And beyond that, they have no obligation to shelter anybody. They've been offering year-round shelter, but they were saying that because of the budget, they were going to scale back and do just the bare minimum of offering shelter 5 months out of the year. But we came out and we fought that fight and we won it and we got $17 million put back in. But at any rate, we have to deal with the federal government as well. And the federal government was talking about cutting $5.7 billion, with a B, from HUD housing. That is Housing and Urban Development. And that department creates Section 8 housing for poor people across the country. Here in Washington, D.C., we have over 11,000 HUD housing vouchers citywide. And there was a threat to cut 5,000, or almost half, of the citywide HUD housing vouchers. Well, as it turns out, Congress has scaled back the cuts, and now they're only talking about cutting $1.4 billion. And so, rather than losing 5,000 vouchers here in D.C., we might only lose 1,250, which is still a loss, but it's not as big a loss as what they had threatened originally. And so we can take that as a gain and as a win. But as it turns out, what happens on Capitol Hill trickles down to DC government as well. And so if the HUD housing is cut at all, those people, if they can't find some other way to maintain their own housing to pay their own rent, they'll become homeless, and that will add to the number of homeless people that DC has. And because the law requires that they shelter all people who need it during the five coldest months of the year. If these cuts occur during the winter, then the city will have to scramble to get these people housed or sheltered, and that will cut into the $17 million that we got put back into homeless services. And so if this cut occurs on the federal level, we might be back at square one on April 1st. Let's hope not. But here in D.C., as it turns out, all over the country actually, the fastest growing segment of the homeless population is families. From January of 2008 to January 2009, the number of homeless families grew by 25% in the D.C. metro area. And this is getting to be a really big problem. You see, when individuals become homeless, folk tend to blame that individual for their own missteps, whether it was drug addiction or alcoholism or not paying the rent or some other personal vice. But when families become homeless, people tend to blame the economy. They're more sympathetic to families that become homeless, but that sympathy doesn't house people. And in closing, I want to address the issue of moving the homeless from homelessness to self-sufficiency. Well, you know, I do have to give the city credit for housing some of the homeless. Like I said earlier, the program that was begun during the Fenton administration has housed about 1,500 homeless people at this point, but it still falls woefully short of ending the problem of homelessness. And so we still have more homeless people than we had before that program was begun. And during his administration, there were people who talked about how we're warehousing the homeless, and that is very much the truth, that we are warehousing the homeless. In the past, there have been programs that were geared toward getting people out of homelessness, and while I can't speak to their success or lack thereof, I do know that when you look at the raw numbers of homeless people as we count them every January, that number just keeps going up. And so during a budget crunch, during an economic downturn, when funding is cut, what they cut is the funding for programs that would move people out of homelessness, and they retain the funding for shelter. And so what we end up with is just bare-bones shelter that does nothing but warehouse the homeless, and that has been a major problem when it comes to dealing with the homeless issue. Well, as it turns out, myself and others have done some peer-to-peer mentoring. I myself have actually gone out to the D.C. General Hospital, which is now being used as a shelter because the hospital was closed 10 years ago, and I've gone to the family shelter on the D.C. General grounds, and I've actually done some tutoring of the women there. And we're really working to help them get their GED and to get jobs and to become self-sufficient, and hoping to get some sort of funding for what we do so that we can continue to do this work and do it in a more robust manner. As it turns out, here in Washington, D.C., the government likes for you to go out without their money first and to do what you do and get results, and then if they like the results you get, then they fund you on the back end. And at Streets and Shark, we've really been doing this work for a while, and hopefully the city will begin to recognize what we do and to give us funding so that we can do it better and in a bigger and better way. And so all we can do is hope, and as we move into this new year, into 2012, we'll see what the future holds.